now. If you attempt to influence the planet, then you will leave me no choice but to take action against your vessel. What ship? Let me see, the ship is coming from Earth. But is it Sering's Earth or my Earth? Or no Earth is left for any ship to come. Silently, they stopped sending so long, so cold, so let me out, you bitch, you witch, Eliza, you stole my mind. My name can't keep me here. Let me wake, let me speak, let me die, let me be something. So much for that. It really is just the same line as before. We've got nowhere except... What? Guyan demanded. I want to try something a bit lateral, Holston explained. Is it likely to get us blown up ahead of schedule? I don't think so. Then you try whatever you've got, Mason. Holston steeled himself and transmitted a simple, surreal question. Is there anybody else we could talk to? You're taking the piss, Lane said in his ear. Better ideas? I'm engineering, we don't do ideas. He managed a weak smile at that one. Everyone else was on tenterhooks, awaiting the response. Save for Guyan, who was glowering at Holston as though his fierce regard could somehow inspire the classicist to greater efforts of antiquarianism. Would you like to speak to my sister?
Please, 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 please!
Lane swore again, and Guyan stared down at his own screen. Another murmur of baffled speculation was rising around them. Right, look, I have a theory, Holston explained. We're talking to some sort of automated system still, obviously. Even if it's programmed to respond in a human-like manner. But there's something else. It's different. It seems less rational. So we could see if it will let us do things that the main expert system won't. Worst comes to worst, we could even turn it against the main system somehow. I don't know. But what is it? Vitas asked him. Why would they have two systems? Failsafe? Holston suggested, because he was keeping his worst suspicions very much to himself.
Try it, Guyan said. Cast, I want some solutions if this turns ugly. Our current course will bring us into the planet's attraction at the right speed to make orbit. The only alternative is to stop decelerating now and just fly past and then... And then what?
The question was plainly rhetorical, the hard-pressed commander showing the working of his sums.
Then we set course for the next point on the star maps and somehow hope there's something different there? We've seen this planet now. This is going to be our home. Mason, tell it.
Why, yes, Eliza. Please let us talk to your sister. Holston tried to match the expert system's polite and formal manner of speech. He was not sure what they would get back, and he was ready to shut down the comms if it was just that anguished mad babbling, because there could be no dialogue with that, no possibility of negotiating with that internalized storm of insanity.
We're being told to stand by, he reported, when the instruction came.
After that, there was nothing else for a long time. The Gilgamesh continued to fall inexorably towards the green planet's gravity well. The satellite was still silent when Lane and her team began their anxious watch over ship's systems, as the ancient Ark ship began to creak and strain at the unnatural imposition of an external source of mass, large and close enough to claw at the vessel's structure. Everyone there felt a subtle shifting. For the whole waking portion of the journey, their perception of gravity had come from the ship's gradual deceleration. Now an alien force was reaching for them, subtly tugging with insubstantial ghost fingers the first touch of the world below.
All signs suggest stable orbit for now,
Lane reported tensely. There followed a slow-motion comedy as deceleration ceased and then rotation began, gravity creeping across the floor to make a new home against the wall, and the Gilgamesh's consoles and fittings shudderingly adjusting. For a minute there was no point of reference, a room full of weightless people trying to remember their long-ago training, hauling on each other to get to the right surface before they could be slammed into it. In the commotion, awkwardness, and a series of minor medical calls, the whole business of their imminent destruction was almost forgotten.
New transmission, Holston alerted them, as the signal came in.
In his ear, those same female tones sounded. But the intonation, the rhythm of the speech, was quite different, and stripped free of that tortured backing. I am Dr. Evarana Kern, Chief Scientist and Administrator of the Second Bryn Exaltation Project, was his translation. Even through the filter of archaic Imperial Sea, the voice was stern and proud.
What are you? What is your provenance?
That doesn't sound like a computer, Lane murmured.
Of course it's a computer, Vita snapped. It's simply a more sophisticated approximation of... Enough! Guyon cut through the argument. Mason!
We are an arkship from Earth, Holston sent, seeking permission to establish a colony on Kern's world. If the thing he was talking to was in any way human, he guessed that a little flattery couldn't harm.
Whose Earth, though?
Sering's Earth or my Earth? Came the swift reply. Now that they were in orbit, there was barely any delay. It was almost like a real conversation. Real conversation with a faceless machine mind, Holston reminded himself. He sent his translation round the room, looking for help. But nobody had any suggestion as to what the satellite meant. Before he could give any kind of answer, a new transmission came in.
I do not recognize you. You are not human. You are not from Earth. You have no business here. Eliza shows me all that she sees of you, and there is nothing of Earth in you. But why can I not see you for myself? Why can I not open my eyes? Where are my eyes? Where are my eyes? Where are my eyes?
And then an abrupt cessation of the message, leaving Holston shaken, because that was it. A segue straight into the voice of madness, without a moment's warning.
I don't think it's a computer, he said,
but soft enough that only Lane heard him. She was reading over his shoulder still, and nodded soberly.
Our vessel is the Ark ship Gilgamesh from Earth. This ship was built after your time.
He prepared and sent, with a bitter awareness of the sheer understatement implicit in that. He was dreading what they might receive back.
Good evening. I am Eliza Kern, composite expert system I'm instructed to require you to return to your point of origin. Send them away, I don't want them. If they say they came from Earth, they can go back, go back, go back. I don't want, can't, no, 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 no.
It's completely deranged, Cast stated flatly, and that with the benefit of only half of what was being said. Can we keep the planet between us or something?
Not and retain stable orbit, one of Guyon's team reported. Seriously, remember how big the Gil is. We can't just flit him about like your drones.
Holston was already sending, because Guyon had stopped dictating and it now seemed to be down to him.
Return to Earth is not possible. Please, may we speak to your sister again, Eliza?
Pleading for the life of humanity in a dead language, having to make the call between artificial intransigence and what he was increasingly sure was real human crazy. That other voice again, delivering a rant that he got down as,
Why can't you just go back where you came from? Are you Sering's people? Did we win? Did we throw you out? Are you here to finish what he started?
What happened here? Demanded Vetus incredulously.
What's Sering? A warship?
Earth is no longer habitable, Holston sent, even as Lane warned. That's going to push her over the edge for sure, Mason. He had dispatched the message even as she said it, the hollow feeling in his stomach arriving a moment later. She's right at that. But there was a measure more sanity in Dr. Avrana Kern's voice when it replied.
Nonsense.
Explain. The Gilgamesh archives had histories, but whoever would have thought they would need translating into a language only historians were now interested in. Instead, Holston did his best. History 101 for the lost time traveller, based on best guesses as to what had actually happened beyond the dawn of his recorded time, back when the old empire had held sway. There was so little he could actually say. The gap between the last thing Kern must know and the earliest definite fact that Holston could rely on was insuperable. There was a civil war between factions of the Empire, he explained. Both sides unleashed weapons the nature of which I do not understand, but which were effective in devastating higher civilization on Earth and completely destroying the colonies. He remembered seeing the eggshell ruins on Europa. The in-system colonies had all predated any apparent later expertise in terraforming that the Empire had come to possess. They had been hothouse flowers on planets and moons haphazardly altered to better support life, reliant on biospheres that must have required constant adjustment. On Earth, people had lapsed back into barbarism. Elsewhere, when the power had failed, when the electromagnetic weapons had destroyed the vital engines, or the electronic viruses murdered the artificial minds, they had died. They had died in alien cold, in reverting atmospheres, under corrosive skies. Often, they had died still fighting each other. So little had been left intact. He typed it all out. As though writing an abstract to a history text, he noted with dry precision
that a post-war industrial society may have persisted for almost a century, and may even have been regaining some of the sophistication of its predecessors when the ice came. The choked atmosphere that had smothered the planet in gloom had shouldered out the sun, resulting in a midnight glacial cold that had left very little of that abortive rebirth. Looking back down the well of time, Holston could make no definite statements about those who were left, nor about the frozen age that followed. Some scientists had speculated that, when the ice was at its height, the entire remnant human population of Earth had been no more than 10,000 all told, huddling in caves and holes around the equator and staring out at a horizon rigid with cold. He went on into more certain waters, the earliest unearthed records of what he could truly think of as his people. The ice had been retreating. Humanity had sprung back swiftly, expanded, fought its small wars, reindustrialized, tripping constantly over reminders of what the species had previously achieved. Human eyes had looked to the skies again, which were crossed by so many moving points of light. And he told Kern why they could not go back. Because of the war, the Empire's war from thousands of years before. For so long, scholars had taught that the further the ice receded, the better for the world. And yet nobody had guessed what poisons and sicknesses had been caught up in that ice, like insects in amber, the encroaching cold protecting the shivering biosphere from the last excesses of Empire. "There is no returning to Earth," he sent to the pensively silent satellite. "In the end, we could not counterbalance the increasing toxicity of the environment. So we built the Ark ships. In the end, all we had was old star maps to guide us. We are the human race, and we've had no transmissions from any other Arks to say that they found anywhere to stay. Dr. Avrana Kern, this is all we have. Please, may we settle on your planet." Because he was thinking in human terms, he expected a decent pause then for his opposite number to digest all that potted history. Instead, one of the science crew shouted out, "New energy readings! It's activating something!" "A weapon?" Guyon demanded, and all the screens briefly went blank, then flared to life again, with nonsense scattering across them, fragments of code and text and simple static. It's got into the Gilgamesh control system," Lane spat. "It's attacking our security. No, it's through. Fuck, we're open. It's got full control. This is what it did to your drones, Cast, the ones it didn't just vaporise. We're fucked. Do what you can," Guyon urged her. "What the fuck do you think I can do? I'm locked out." "Balls to your cultural specificity, Mason. It's all over our fucking system like a disease." "How's our orbit?" someone asked. "I have no feedback, no instrumentation at all." Vetus sounded very slightly tense. "However, I've not felt any change in thrust, and mere loss of power or control should not affect our position relative to the planet." "Like all those hulks orbiting Earth," Holston thought helplessly. "Those fried, dead ships, with the vacuum-dried bodies of their crew still in place after thousands of years." Abruptly, the lights jumped and flickered, and then a face appeared on every screen. It was a bony, long-jawed face. That it was a woman's was not immediately obvious. Details kept filling in. Dark hair drawn back, skin shaded and textured, harsh lines about the mouth and eyes. Unflattering by modern criteria, but who could name the ancient aesthetics that this face acknowledged? It was a face from an era and a society and an ethnicity that time had otherwise erased. The kinship between it and the crew of the Gilgamesh seemed tenuous, coincidental. The voice that rang out through the speakers was unmistakably the same, but this time it was speaking the crew's own common language, although the lips did not sync. "I am Dr. Avrana Kern. This is my world. I will brook no interference with my experiment. I have seen what you are. You are not from my Earth. You are not my humanity. You are monkeys. Nothing but monkeys. You are not even my monkeys. My monkeys are undergoing uplift, the great experiment. They are pure. They will not be corrupted by you mere humans. You are nothing but monkeys of a lesser order. You mean nothing to me. Can she hear us? Guyon asked quietly.
If your own systems can hear you, then I can hear you, Kern's voice spat out.
Are we to understand that you are condemning the last survivors of your own species to death? It was a remarkably mannered, patient display from Guyon.
Because it seems that is what you're saying. You are not my responsibility, Kern pronounced. This planet is my responsibility. Please, Lane said, ignoring Guyon when he gestured at her to shut up. I don't know what you are, if you're human or machine or whatever, but we need your help.
The face froze, nothing but a still image for a handful of heartbeats.
Lane, if you've...
Guyon started, and then abruptly, Kern's image began to break up, distorting and corrupting on screen, features bloating or atrophying and then flickering into nothing. The voice spoke again, a plaintive whisper in its native tongue, and only Holston could know what it was saying.
I am human. I must be human. Am I the system? Am I the upload? Is there anything of me left? Why can I not feel my body? Why can I not open my eyes?
The other thing. The Eliza thing. It was mentioning some other help, Lane murmured, although surely even a whisper would be overheard. Can we just ask it?
I will help you, Kern said, speaking their language again, sounding calmer now. I will help you leave. You have all the universe except this world of mine. You can go anywhere.
But we can't, Guyon started. Then Lane broke in.
I'm back in, checking all systems.
A tense minute to ensure that, at the very least, the ship's computer was telling her that everything was still working.
We've got new data flagged up. It's just dumped a whole load of stuff on us. The Gilgamesh recognises star maps. Mason, I've received some stuff in that jabber of yours.
Holston scanned over the jumble of data.
Not sure, but it's linked to the star maps.
His mouth was dry.
Other terraforming projects?
I think we've been given the keys to the next system. It's giving us destinations. It's selling out its neighbours, was what he did not say, given that it was listening. It's bribing us to go away.
I think something here might even be access codes.
How far? Guyon demanded. Just under 2 light-years, Vitas reported briskly.
Just a step, really.
Through a long, stressed silence, they waited for Guyon's decision. The face of Avrana Kern was back on some of the screens, glowering at them, twitching, distorting, reforming. Chapter 2.6 Metropolis. Negotiations with the locals have gone sufficiently well, now that Portia and her party have established their superiority, and the incumbents have lent the 3 travellers a male to serve as a guide in the lands to the north. The creature is slightly smaller than Portia's own male companion, but of a quite different character, bold to the point of impudence by Portia's standards. He has a name. Call him Fabian. Portia, whilst aware that males give themselves names, has very seldom needed to know any, even with the concentration of that gender to be found at Great Nest. She guesses that in a small family unit such as these locals, males are likely to be more self-reliant, therefore both more capable and more independently minded. Still, she finds his brashness off-putting. Bianca appears to find him less objectionable, and on their trip north, Portia catches Fabian displaying for her, a tentative offer to give her his sperm. Bianca has not yet shown herself receptive, but Portia notes that she has not chased him off, either. Portia herself has put several clutches of eggs behind her. Females seldom depart Great Nest without having passed on their lineage, and she feels this current behaviour is distracting from their mission. On the other hand, Bianca has fought for her, and probably considers playing with this new male her reward. Portia only hopes she can keep her desires in check. It would be more diplomatically advantageous if Fabian was not killed and eaten during the throes of passion. They do not have to travel far to the north to see just what has been growing here at the edge of the Great Nest's web of awareness. Soon, they begin coming across felled trees, their trunks showing a combination of blackening, chewing, and surprisingly clean cuts, often painstakingly scissored into sections. Frequently, the entire root system has been unearthed as well, ensuring that nothing will regrow. The forest is under wide-scale attack, its fringes being gnawed away. Fabian can remember when there were more trees, he communicates. The clearing of land continues year to year, and Fabian's inherited understanding suggests that it is happening faster now than in his mother's time. Beyond that ragged edge, the other trees, the foreign trees, are set out in discrete stands. They are small and squat and bulbous, with fleshy leaves and trunks that are warty with protrusions. The exaggerated space between each copse is a firebreak, something the spiders are very familiar with. Their planet's oxygen levels are higher than Earth's. Lightning-sparked fires are a constant threat. What they're seeing is no work of nature. This is a plantation on a grand scale, and the labourers tending it are plainly visible. Everywhere Portia turns her eyes, there are more of them. And if she looks beyond the checkerboard of groves, she can make out a steep-sided mound that must be the upper reaches of the plantation owner's colony, the bulk of it being hidden underground. A pall of smoke hangs over it like bad weather. Portia's kin are well aware that they are not the sole inheritors of their world. Whilst they cannot know how the nanovirus has been reshaping life here for millennia, there are certain species she shares the planet with that her people recognise as something more than animals. The spitters are a low-end example, barely removed from a state of brute nature. But to look into their small, weak eyes is nonetheless to recognise that here is a thing of intellect, and hence danger. The western oceans that Portia's great nest looks over are home to a type of stomatopod with which her people have cautious, ritualised relations. Their ancestors were fierce, inventive hunters, equipped with unparalleled eyesight and deadly natural weapons, and used to living in colonies where negotiations over living space were common. They, too, proved fertile ground for the virus, and have developed on parallel lines with Portia's own kin. Perhaps because of their aquatic environment, perhaps because they are by nature prone to wait for prey, their society is simple and primitive by Portia's standards. But the two species have nothing to compete over, and in the literal zone, they sometimes swap gifts, the fruits of the land in exchange for the fruits of the sea. Of more pressing concern are the ants. Portia understands the nature of ants. There are colonies near the Great Nest, and she has both personal and genetically encoded dealings with them to draw upon. It is the Great Nest's collective experience that ant colonies are complicated neighbours. They must be dealt with decisively. Left to themselves, they will always expand in a manner detrimental to any species that the ants themselves have no use for, which would naturally include Portia's own. They can be destroyed. Her inherited understandings include chronicles of such conflicts. But war, with even a small colony, is costly and wasteful. Alternatively, preferably, they can be accommodated and limited by careful manipulation of their decisions. Portia knows that ants are not like her people, nor like the spitters or the stomatopods of the western shallows. She knows that individual ants themselves cannot be treated with, communicated with, or even threatened. Her comprehension is coarse, of a necessity, but approximates to the truth. Each ant does not think. It has a complex set of responses based on a wide range of stimuli, many of which are themselves chemical messages produced by other ants in response to still more eventualities. There is no intelligence within a colony, but there is such a hierarchy of interacting and codependent instinct that it seems to Portia that some manner of entity is behind a colony's actions and reactions. With ants, the nanovirus has simultaneously failed and succeeded. Amongst the ants' network of reactive decision-making, it has inculcated a strategy of experimentation and investigation that approaches rigorous scientific method. But it has not led to intellect such as any human or spider would recognise. Ant colonies evolve and adapt, throw up new castes, investigate and make use of resources, devise new technologies, refine them and interrelate them, and all this without anything approaching a consciousness to direct it. There is no hive mind, but there is a vast and flexible biological difference engine, a self-perfecting machine dedicated to the continuance of itself. It does not understand how what it does functions, but it constantly expands its behavioural repertoire and builds upon those trial-and-error paths that prove fruitful. Portia's understanding of all this is very limited,
but she has a grasp of how ants do and do not work. She knows that individual ants cannot innovate, but that the colony can, in a strange way, make what appear to be informed decisions. Application of force and reward, a narrowing of the colony's viable options so that the most advantageous is the one the spiders intend it to choose, can lead to a colony accepting boundaries on its territory and its place in the world, and even to become a productive partner. The colonies are perfect exponents of game theory. They will cooperate where that course is less costly and more beneficial than other strategies, such as all-out genocidal war. The colonies that she is already familiar with, near Great Nest, are surely less than a tenth the size of what she is now looking at. Fabian explains that there were once several warring colonies here, but one has become dominant. Instead of driving its lesser neighbours to extinction, the ruling colony has incorporated them into its own survival strategy, permitting their continuance in return for making them into extensions of itself, utilising food that they gather and technologies they have developed. It is this world's first superstate. Portia and the others have a brief, agitated conversation. This supercolony is far enough from Great Nest not to threaten it now, but they can look ahead and envisage that its very existence here endangers their people's future. A solution must be found, but to think through a plan like that, Portia's kin at home will need all the information she can bring back to them. They're going to have to continue their journey into the land of the ants. Fabian is surprisingly useful. He has travelled further than this himself. In fact, his family makes a habit of it. It is dangerous, but they have developed ways of minimising the risk of raising the alarm. And when hunting has been lean, the ants' larders are a last resort. A new column of ants has arrived, and they are here for timber. The spiders retreat further into the trees and watch as the insects set to work breaking up the already fallen trunks into manageable sections, using acid and the strength of their jaws. Portia is swift to spot something new, a cast that she has never seen before. Smaller branches are severed and carried off by unexceptional-seeming workers, but the large trunks are dealt with by ants with long, curved mandibles equipped with jagged inner edges. These they fix to the circumference of a trunk and move their mouthparts in incremental opposition, scoring around and around so as to cut a circular section away. Those mandibles did not emerge from the cocoon with the rest of the ant, however. They gleam in the sunlight, in a way quite unlike anything Portia has seen before. Rigid, toothed sleeves that make remarkably quick work of biting and sawing the wood into pieces. With Fabian taking the lead, the spiders ambush an ant logging party, trapping and killing them quickly and efficiently, then decapitating them and dissecting them for their scent glands. The ants are smaller than Portia, between 15 and 30 centimetres long, and the spiders are stronger, swifter and far more efficient fighters one-on-one. What they must avoid is a general alarm, where large sections of the colonies are mobilised against them. The ants communicate principally by pheromones. To Portia's keen chemical senses, the air is thick with them. They use the ants' scent to disguise their own, and they carry the severed heads with them, secured to their abdomens. In extremis, they can try to divert ant attention by a morbid form of puppetry, manipulating the dead antennae of their victims in a pretense of communication. They travel swiftly. Their victims will be missed, but the initial response will target where they were, not where they are now. Their road is the high one. They travel through the upper reaches of the ants' plantations, and whenever they reach a firebreak, one of them scuttles across the intervening ground with a thread that then forms the spine of a temporary bridge. With their own scent disguised, they travel over the ants' heads and beneath their notice. Fabian demonstrates that the protrusions on the trunks of the ant-tended trees can be lanced with a fang to release a sweet, nourishing liquid, not unlike the honeydew of aphids, a taste they know the ants relish. This plantation agriculture is obviously a useful secret, and Portia adds it to the list of observations to include in her report when she returns home. For now, they press on towards the main colony mound, avoiding the ants where they can, killing them swiftly where they cannot. Each small alarm will contribute to a generally raised awareness across the nest, until significant insect resources are devoted to locating intruders whose presence has been deduced by the colony's ineluctable internal logic. Portia's goal is to investigate the central colony mound, which promises more secrets. During the day, the air shimmers over parts of it,
and there are plumes of smoke venting from stubby chimneys. At night, some of the ants' entrances glow dimly. In the darkness of their home, the ants start fires in the oxygen-rich atmosphere, ignited by exothermic reactions from chemicals that certain of their castes can produce. Complex arrangements of internal passageways use the temperature differentials to stimulate airflow, heating, cooling, and oxygenating their nests. The ants also use fire for land clearance and as a weapon. Porsche's world, the underlying geology that existed before the terraforming, is rich in shallow deposits of metals, and the ants dig deep to build their nests. In this colony, centuries of burning has led to charcoal production, and occasional inadvertent smelting has been systematized into the forging of tools. The blind watchmaker has been busy. Entering the mound itself is more than Portia dares, and she is tempted to leave with all the information she has gathered. Curiosity urges her on, though. Atop the mound, beneath the hanging shroud of smoke, is a spire that gleams in the sun, brightly enough to draw the eye. Like all of her kind, she is driven to investigate anything new. This reflective beacon is the highest point on the mound, and Portia wants to know what it is. Portia finds her band of infiltrators a vantage point in the nearest plantation to the mound and considers the paths taken by the chains of ant workers. Inside the brain that bulks out the underside of her body, she has fallen into a way of thinking that her diminutive ancestress would recognize, constructing an internal map of the world and then deconstructing that to find the best course to where she needs to go next. "I will go alone," she instructs Bianca. "If I do not return, then you must go home and report." Bianca understands. Portia descends by line from the tree that provided her watchtower and begins her journey, following the itinerary that she spent so long plotting. The ants follow particular paths that their constant travel has packed down into flat, smooth roads representing the most efficient routes. Portia navigates a delicate, cautious path between these thoroughfares. She moves haltingly, pausing, quivering, then drifting on, gauging the lightly gusting wind and letting her onward progress follow its patterns, as if she herself was nothing but some overlarge piece of wind-blown debris. The vibrations of her movement are swallowed up in the entropy of the world at large. With her scent disguised, she can ghost past the near-blind ants, as though she is invisible. The going gets more complex and more dangerous as she reaches the mound itself. Her careful plan knows constant amendment, and she comes close to discovery several times. Once, she uses the detached head of one of her victims, in a brief moment of feigned contact, to put off a wandering cleaner who is paying too close attention to her. Her painstaking progress has taken hours, and the sun has set. This leads to outdoor ant activity dropping off, and makes her progress easier. Only then does she reach the summit. The ants have built a stumpy spire here, as already observed, and atop it is something new, a pale crystal that gleams translucently in the moonlight. She has no idea what this is for, and so she waits in the hope that the ants themselves will show her. After the moon begins to dip towards the far horizon, they do. All of a sudden, there are ants issuing out onto the mound's summit in considerable numbers, so that Portia must move rapidly and keep moving until she has found somewhere that they do not intend to occupy, which means some way further back down the shallow gradient. The insects are forming a carpet, a net of their bodies, touching antennae and limbs. Portia is baffled. They seem to be awaiting something, or that is how she interprets their behaviour. It is un-ant-like. It concerns her. Then, another of the insects emerges from a small hole at the base of the spire and climbs up it. It flicks one antennae towards the crystal, with the other directed downwards to make contact with the general host gathered below it. Portia's wide, round eyes gather as much of the moonlight as they can and focus on this newcomer, this small, unprepossessing ant. It has a prosthesis on its antenna, like the tree cutters, but this is a fine cap of the same material, metal, though Portia does not know that, that tapers to invisibility, so that the ant is now touching the crystal with a tiny, delicate, hair-like wire. And as Portia watches, the ants begin to dance. She has never seen anything like it. Shivers go through the entire mat of them, apparently originating in that contact between metal feeler and crystal, and spreading through the assembled host. They're sent into constant waves of motion, each transmitting to its neighbours some rhythmic message that holds the entire congregation rapt. Portia watches in quiet bewilderment. She is no mathematician. She does not quite grasp the series of arithmetical progressions, series and transformations that are represented in the waves of motion passing through the ants, no more than the ants themselves do. But she can grasp that there is some pattern there, some significance to what she is seeing. She does her best to interpret what she sees in light of her experiences and those experiences she has inherited, but there is nothing comparable in the whole history of her own world. The ants feel the same. Their constant exploration of possibilities has resulted in this solitary contact with something vast and intangible, and the colony processes the information it receives and attempts to find a purpose for it. More and more of its biological processing power being applied to the task, more and more ants quivering under the pulsed rhythms of a distant radio signal. Intent on trying to find pattern and plan in the scene before her, Portia's hungry eyes note one more element, and she wonders, is that important? Like humans, Portia's people are quick to see patterns, sometimes when there are none. Hence, she makes the association quickly, seeing the timing as too close to be coincidental. When the gathering of ants breaks up and hurries inside, without warning and all at once, it is just as the traveller, the swift-moving star that she has often watched coursing across the sky, is passing beneath the horizon. She makes a plan then, swiftly and without much forethought. She is intrigued, and her species is driven to investigate anything new, just as the ants are, though in very different ways. Once most of the ants are gone, she approaches the spire carefully, wary of triggering some alarm. Lifting her palps, she lets the wind ruffle them, feeling its strength and direction, and matching her movements to it. She ascends carefully, foot over foot, until she finds the crystal before her. It does not seem so large, not to her. She sets to spinning a complex package of silk that she holds with her rear legs. She is keenly aware of being at the very centre of the great colony. A mistake at this point would go very badly. She has left matters almost too late. Her presence, through the vibrations of her work, has been detected. From its hole at the spire's base, the small ant that led the congregation abruptly emerges and touches one of her feet with its uncovered antenna. Immediately it lets out an alarm, a chemical sharp with outrage and fury at finding an alien, an intruder, in this place. As the scent passes outwards, it is picked up by tunnel guards and other castes that have remained close to the exterior. The message is passed on and multiplied. Portia drops on the ant beneath her and kills it with one bite, removing its head as she did with the others, although she knows she cannot bluff her way out of this one. Instead, she scuttles up the spire again, seeking as much height as it will give, and seizes the crystal from the top. She secures her two trophies to her abdomen with webbing, even as the ants begin to swarm out over the exterior of their colony. She sees plenty there with tools and modifications that she is suddenly no longer sufficiently curious to investigate. She jumps. An unassisted leap from the spire would land her in their very midst, to be savagely held and stung and dismembered alive. At the apex of her upward spring, though, her hind legs kick out their burden of carefully folded silk, forming a fine-spun net spread between them that catches the wind Portia was so carefully measuring earlier. It is not taking her quite back towards Bianca and the others, but she has no control over that. At this moment, her chief priority is to get away, gliding over the heads of the enraged insects as they lift their metal-sheathed mandibles and try to work out where she could have gone. Her descendants will tell the story of how Portia entered the Temple of the Ants and stole the eye of their god. Chapter 2.7 Exodus. Guyon took his time over his decision. As the Gilgamesh followed its long curving path around this solitary island of life in the vast desert of space, its trajectory constantly balanced between the momentum that would fling it away and the gravity that would draw it in. The face of Dr. Avrana Kern, whoever and whatever she truly was, flickered and ghosted on their screens, sometimes inhuman in its stoic patience, at other times twisted by waves of nameless, involuntary emotions, the mad goddess of the green planet. Knowing that Kern was listening and could not be shut out, Guyan had no way to receive the counsel of his crew, but Holston felt that the man would not have listened anyway. He was in command, the responsibility his alone to bear. And of course, there was only one answer for all the agonized pondering that Guyan might give to the question. Even if the sentry habitat had not possessed weapons capable of destroying the Gilgamesh, the Ark ship's systems were at Kern's mercy. The airlocks, the reactor, all the many tools they relied on to keep this bubble of life from the claws of the void, Kern could just switch it all off.
"We'll go,"
Guyan agreed at last, and Holston reckoned he wasn't the only one who was relieved to hear it.
"Thank you for your help, Dr. Avrana Kern. We will seek out these other systems and attempt to establish ourselves there. We will leave this planet in your care."
Kern's face sprang into animation on the screens, though still moving almost randomly and completely divorced from the words.
"Of course you will. Go take your barrel of monkeys elsewhere."
Lane was murmuring, "What is this business about monkeys?" in his ear, and Holston had been wondering the same thing. "Monkeys are a sort of animal. We have records regarding them. The Empire used them in scientific experiments. They looked something like people. Here, I've got images."
"Gilgamesh has got a course plotted," Vitas stated.
Guyan looked it over.
"Replot. I want us to swing by this planet here, the gas giant. We won't be able to gain anything useful by slingshotting." "Just do it," the commander growled. "Here, get me an orbit."
Vitas pursed her lips primly.
"I don't see what would be served by an orbit."
"Make it happen," Guyan told her,
glowering at one of Kern's images as though waiting for it to challenge him. They felt the change of forces as the Gilgamesh's fusion reactor brought the engines back online, ready to coax the vast mass of the Ark ship off its comfortable orbit and hurl it out into space once more. Without warning, Kern's face was gone from the screens, and Lane quickly ran a check of all systems, finding no trace of the intruder's presence there.
"Which is no guarantee of anything," she pointed out. "We could be riddled with spy routines and security backdoors and who knows what."
She did not add, "Kern could have set us to explode somewhere in deep space," which Holston reckoned was generous of her. He saw the same thought on everyone's face, but they had no leverage, no options, just hope. Pinning the whole future of the human race on hope, considered. But then, hadn't the whole Ark-shipped project been just that?
"Mason, tell us about the monkeys,"
Lane suggested. He shrugged.
"Oh, just speculation, but the thing was talking about an exaltation program.
Exaltation of beasts, the old stories say."
"How do you exalt a monkey?"
Lane was studying the archived images.
"Funny-looking little critters, aren't they?"
"The signal to the planet."
"And the mathematics," Vitas mused.
"Are they expecting the monkeys to respond?"
Nobody had any answers.
"You've set our course?"
Guyan demanded.
"Naturally,"
came Vitas's immediate reply.
"Fine. So the whole universe is ours except the one planet worth living on,"
Commander stated.
"So, we don't stake it all on whatever's at this next project we're being sent to. We'd be fools to. It could be as hostile as here. It could be worse. There might not be anything there. I want humanity, to have a foothold here, just in case."
"A foothold where?" Holston demanded.
"You said yourself that was the only planet here."
Guyan brought up a representation of one of the system's other planets. A streaky, bloated-looking gas giant like some of the outer planets of Earth's system, then narrowing in on a pallid, bluish moon.
"The Empire colonized several moons back in Earth's system. We have automated base units that can carve us out a home there. Power, heat, hydroponics, enough to survive."
"Are you proposing this as the future of the human race?" Vitas asked flatly.
"The future? No. A future? Yes," Guyan told them all. "We will head off first to see if this Kern has sold us something of worth or not. After all, whatever's there isn't going anywhere. But we're not betting all we have on that. We'll leave a functioning colony behind us, just in case. Engineering, I want a base unit ready to deploy once we arrive."
Right."
Lane was running calculations, looking at what the Gilgamesh's sensors could say about the moon.
"I see frozen oxygen, frozen water, even tidal heating from the gas giant's pull.
But it's still a long way short of cosy. The automated systems are going to take, well, a long time, decades, to get everything set up so that someone can be left there. I know. Detail a roster of science and engineering to be woken at regular intervals to check progress. Wake me when it's near completion.
At the general groan, Guyon glared around at them.
What? Yes, it's back to the chambers. Of course it is. What did you think? Only difference is, we've one more wake-up call before we set off out of the system. We maximize our chances as a species. We establish ourselves here.
He was looking at the screens, where the gradually receding green disk of Kern's world was still showing. The unspoken intent to return was plain in both his face and tone. Vetus had meanwhile been running her own simulations.
Commander, I appreciate your aims, but there was limited testing of the automatic base systems, and the environment they will be deployed into does seem extreme.
The old Empire had its colonies, Guyon stated.
Which died, Holston thought. Which all died. True, they had died in the war, but they had primarily died because they were not stable or self-sufficient, and when the normal business of civilization was interrupted, they had not been able to save themselves.
You won't get me living there, if I have any choice in the matter.
All doable, Lane reported. I've a base module ready for jettison. Give it long enough and who knows what we might cook up down there. A regular palace, probably. Hot and cold running methane in every room.
Just shut up and do it, Guyon told her.
The rest of you, get ready to go back to suspension.
First off, Cast interrupted, who wants to see a monkey?
They all looked at him blankly, and he grinned.
I'm still getting signals from the last drone, remember? So let's look around.
Are you sure that's safe? Holston put in, but Cast was already sending the images to their screens. The drone was moving over an unbroken canopy of green, that unthinkable wealth of foliage that had been denied to them. Then the viewpoint dipped, and Cast was sending the drone down, corkscrewing it through a gap in the trees, zigzagging its way delicately around a lattice of branches. The world now revealed was awe-inspiring, a vaulted cathedral of forest overshadowed by the interlocking boughs above, like a green sky held up by the pillars of tree trunks. The drone glided on through this vast and cavernous space, keeping ground and canopy equally distant. The expressions of the Gilgamesh crew were hungry and bitter, staring at this forbidden birthright, an Eden not made for human touch.
"What's that ahead?" Lane asked.
"Detecting nothing, just a visual glitch," Cast replied, and then abruptly their viewpoint was swinging wildly, wheeling in mid-air with frustrated forward momentum.
Cast swore, fingers flying as he tried to send new instructions, but the drone seemed to be caught on something invisible. Or near invisible. Holston could only see brief glints in the air as the drone's viewpoint spun and danced. It happened very swiftly. One moment they were staring out into the clear space ahead that the drone was being inexplicably denied, and then a vast, hand-like shadow eclipsed their view. They had a moment's glimpse of many bristling legs spread wide, two fangs like curved hooks striking savagely towards the camera with ferocious speed and savagery. On the second impact, the picture shattered into static. For a long while, nobody said anything. Some, like Holston, just stared at the dead screens. Vetus had gone rigid, a muscle ticking frantically at the corner of her mouth. Lane was replaying the last seconds of that image, analysing.
Extrapolating from the drone and its camera settings, that thing was the best part of a metre long, she remarked at last. Shakily.
That was no fucking monkey, Cast spat.
Behind the Gilgamesh itself, the green world and its orbiting sentinel fell away into obscurity, leaving the Ark ship's crew with, at best, mixed feelings about it. Part 3. War. Chapter 3.1. Rude Awakening. He was hauled unwillingly into consciousness within the close confines of the suspension chamber, with the thought in his mind, didn't I do this before? The question came to him substantially before he recalled his own name. Holston Mason. Sounds familiar. Fragmentary understanding returned to him, as though his brain was ticking off a checklist with Lane. Green Planet. Imperial Sea. Would I like to speak to Eliza? Dr. Evrana Kern. Moon Colony. Moon colony. And he jolted into full comprehension with the absolute certainty that they were going to send him to the colony, to that freezing wasteland of frozen solid atmosphere that Vree Guyan had decided would be humanity's first stab at a new home. Guyan had never liked him. Guyan had no more use for him. They were waking him now to transport him to the colony. No. Why would they wake him before dispatch? What could he contribute to the founding of a lunar colony? They had already taken him there, insensible in his chamber. He was waking in the eggshell confines of the base structure to tend the myoculture vats forever and forever and forever. He could not keep the conviction at bay that they had already done this to him, and he tried to thrash and kick in the close interior of the suspension chamber, shouting loud in his own ears, battering at the cool plastic with shoulders and knees because he could not get his arms up. "I don't want to go!" he was shouting, even though he knew he had already gone. "You can't make me!" even though they could. The lid opened suddenly, wrenched up as soon as the seal broke, and he nearly jackknifed out entirely to hit the floor face first. Arms caught him, and for a moment he just stared around him, unable to work out where he was. "No, no, no. It's all right. It's the key crew room. I'm still on the Gilgamesh. I'm not on the moon. They haven't taken me." The arms that had caught him were being none too gentle about setting him on his feet, and when his knees buckled, someone grabbed him and shook him, ramming his back against the chamber so that the lid slammed shut and trapped a fold of his sleep suit. Someone was shouting at him. They were shouting at him to shut up. Only then did he realize he was screaming at them, the same words over and over, that he didn't want to go, that they couldn't make him. As if to give the lie to that, whoever was manhandling him slapped him across the face, and he heard his voice wind down to a puzzled whimper before he could get control over it. Around then, Holston realized that there were four people in the room, and he didn't know any of them. Three men and a woman, all strangers, total strangers. They wore ship suits, but they weren't key crew. Or if they were, Guyan hadn't woken them for the pass at the Green Planet. Holston blinked at them stupidly. The man who held him was tall, lean, and long-boned, looking around Holston's own age, with little scars around his eyes that spoke of recent surgical correction. Recent, presumably meaning several thousand years ago, before they put him to sleep. The classicist's eyes passed over the others. A young-looking woman, heavily built. A small, thin man, with a narrow face that was withered up on one side, perhaps a suspension chamber side effect. A squat, heavy-jawed man standing by the hatch, who was constantly glancing outside. He was holding a gun. Holding a gun. Holston stared at the weapon, which was some sort of pistol. He was still having difficulty interpreting what he was seeing. He could think of no reason whatsoever why there would be a gun involved in this scenario. Guns were on the manifest for the Gilgamesh, certainly. He was aware that, of all the trappings of old Earth carried onto the Ark ship, guns had certainly not been left behind. On the other hand, they were surely not something to be carried about aboard a spaceship full of delicate systems, with the killing vacuum waiting just outside. Unless the gun was there to force him to go down to the moon colony, but it would hardly take a gun. Cast or a couple of his security detail would surely suffice, and run less risk of damaging something vital aboard the Gilgamesh. Something more vital than Holston Mason. He tried to phrase an intelligent question, but managed just a vague mumble. "You hear that?" the tall, lean man told the others. "He doesn't want to go. How about that, eh?" "Skulls, let's move!" hissed the man at the door. The one with the gun. Holston's eyes kept straying to the weapon. A moment later, he found himself strung between Skulls and the woman, being awkwardly push-pulled through the hatch, the gunman leading, pointing his weapon along the corridor. In Holston's last glimpse through the hatch before Withered Face closed it, he saw that the status panels for the other key crew chambers were all showing empty. He had been the only person left to sleep late. "Someone tell me what's going on," he demanded, although it came out sounding like babble. "We need you," the woman started. "Shut up," snapped Skulls, and she did. By that time, Holston reckoned he could have stumbled along under his own power, but they were hustling him along faster than he could get his feet under him. A moment later, he heard some loud noises from back the way they had come, as if someone had dropped something heavy. It was only when the gunman turned back and began returning fire that he realized the sound had been shooting. The pistol made little tinny noises that were oddly unimpressive, like a big dog with a tiny bark. The answering sounds were thunderous booms that shook the air, and rattled Holston's eardrums, as though the wrath of God was being unleashed in the next room. Disruptors, he recognised. Crowd control weapons relying on detonating pockets of air, theoretically non-lethal, and certainly less dangerous to the ship. "Who's shooting at us?" he got out, and this time the words sounded clear enough.
"Your friends," Scholes told him shortly, which ranked among the world's least comforting answers in the circumstances,
leaving Holston with the twin assurances that his current company did not consider him a friend, and that his actual friends, whoever they were ambivalent at best about hurting him.
"Is the ship... is something wrong with the ship?"
he demanded, his tone telling him second-hand how frightened he must be. His emotions seemed to be buzzing about somewhere else in his mind, kept apart from his higher brain by the slowly thawing wall of the suspension chamber.
"Shut up, or I will hurt you," Scholes told him,
in a tone suggesting that he would enjoy doing so. Holston shut up. The one with the withered face had been lagging behind them, and then suddenly he was down on the ground. Holston thought the man had tripped. He even made an abortive, automatic motion to try and help before he himself was dragged away. Withered Face was not getting up, though, and the gunman knelt by his corpse, dragged a second pistol from the back of the dead man's belt, and then levelled both weapons at attackers Holston had not even seen.
Shot.
No disruptor burst for Withered Face. Someone on the other side, Holston's friends purportedly, had apparently run short of patience, prudence, or mercy. Then there were two other people passing by to give the gunman assistance, a man and a woman, both armed, and the amount of gunfire from behind increased dramatically, but it was plain from Scholes's slowing pace that he reckoned he was safer now. Whether that translated into any greater safety for Holston himself seemed to remain a live question. His mouth instinctively thronged with all manner of protests, questions, pleas, and even threats, but he bit them all back. He was hauled on past another half-dozen armed people, all strangers, all in shipsuits, before being shoved through a hatch and sent sprawling, unceremoniously across the floor of a small systems room, which was just a narrow space between two consoles, with a single screen taking up most of the back wall. There was another gunman there, whose startled reaction to his appearance was probably the closest Holston had yet come to actually being shot. There was also another prisoner, sitting with her back to one of the consoles, with hands secured behind her. The prisoner was Issa Lane, chief engineer. They dumped him beside her, restraining his arms in the same way. Scholes then seemed to lose all interest in him, stepping outside to join a hushed but heated discussion with some of the others, of which Holston could only catch the odd word. He heard no more gunfire. The woman and the gunman who had brought him in were still in the room, meaning that there was barely space for anyone else. The air was stuffy and close, smelling strongly of sweat and faintly of urine. For a moment, Holston caught himself wondering if he had simply dreamt all that he remembered since leaving Earth, if some defect of the suspension chamber had drawn him into some grand hallucination where he, the classicist, was suddenly considered a necessary and useful figure among the crew. He glanced at Lane. She was regarding him miserably. It struck him that there were lines on her face that were foreign to him, and her hair had grown to something more than mere stubble.
"She is. She's catching me up. Am I still the oldest human in the universe? Perhaps just."
He eyed their guards, who seemed to be paying far more attention to what Scholes was saying outside than to their two charges. He essayed a whisper.
"What's going on? Who are these maniacs?"
Lane eyed him bleakly. "Colonists." He considered that one word, which opened a door onto a hidden past where someone, Guyon probably, had royally screwed up.
"What do they want?"
"Not to be colonists."
"Well, yes, I could have guessed that, but they've got guns."
Her expression should have curdled into contempt, stating the obvious when every word might count, but instead she just shrugged. "They got into the armory before it kicked off. So much for Cast's fucking security.
They want to take over the ship?"
"If they have to." He guessed that Cast and the security detail were trying to redeem themselves by doing their best to stop that happening, which had apparently now escalated to pitched gun battles in the fragile corridors of the ship. He had no idea of the numbers involved. The moon colony would house several hundred colonists at least, perhaps with more being kept in suspension there. Surely there weren't 500,000 mutineers currently running loose on the Gilgamesh. And how many did Cast have? Was the man waking up secondary crew to use as foot soldiers and shoving guns into their cold hands? What happened? he demanded, the question aimed more at the universe than anyone in particular.
Glad you asked.
Scholes pushed into the room, virtually elbowing the gunman out to give himself space.
What was it you said when we hauled you out of bed?
I don't want to go, was it?
Well, join the club.
Nobody here signed on for this journey to end up freezing in some death trap on a moon without an atmosphere.
Holston stared at him for a moment, noticing the lean man's long hands clenching, seeing the skin round his eyes and mouth twitch involuntarily. He guessed it was the mark of some drug or other that had been keeping the man awake and going since who knew how long. Scholes himself held no gun, but here was a dangerous, volatile man who had been pushed about as far as he could go.
Sir, Holston began, as calmly as he could manage. You probably know that I'm Holston Mason, classicist. I'm not sure if you actually wanted me, or if you were just after whoever you could get for a hostage, or I don't really know what's going on here. If there's anything, any way that I
can get out with your skin intact,
Scholes interjected.
Well, yes.
Not up to me,
the man replied dismissively, seeming about to turn away. But then he refocused and looked at Holston again, as if with fresh eyes.
Fine. Last time you were about, things were different. But believe me, you do know things. Very valuable things. And I appreciate you're not to blame, old man, but there are lives at stake here. Hundreds of lives. You're in this, like it or not.
Not, Holston decided grimly. But what could he say?
Signal the comms room,
Scholes ordered, and the woman twisted her way over to one of the consoles, virtually sitting on Holston's shoulder as she sent the commands. A long moment later, Guyon's lowering face appeared on the wall screen, glaring thunderously at all and sundry. He, too, looked older to Holston's eyes, and even more lacking in human kindness.
"I take it you're not about to lay down your arms?"
the Gilgamesh's commander snapped.
"You take it right," Scholes replied levelly. "However, there's a friend of yours here. Perhaps you want to renew your acquaintance."
He prodded Holston in the head to make his point. Guyon remained impassive, narrow-eyed.
"What of it?"
There was no real clue that he recognised Holston at all.
"I know you need him. I know where you're intending to jaunt off to, once you've consigned us all to that wasteland,"
Scholes told him.
"I know you'll need your vaunted classicist, when you find all that old tech you're so sure of. And don't bother searching the cargo manifests."
This was said with bitter emphasis by a man who until recently had been merely a part of that cargo.
"Because Nestle here is the next best thing. Not an expert like your old man, but she knows more than anyone else."
He clapped the woman beside him on the shoulder.
"So, let's talk, Guyon. Or else I wouldn't give much for your classicist and your chief engineer's chances."
Guyon regarded him, all of them, without expression.
"Engineer Lane's team is quite capable of covering for her, in her absence," he said, as though she had simply gone down with some transient infection. "As for the other, we have the codes now to activate the Empire installations. The science team can handle it. I will not negotiate with those who defy my authority."
His face vanished, but Scholes stared at the empty screen for a long time afterwards, hands clenched into fists. Chapter 3.2 Fire and the Sword. Generations have passed this green world by, in hope, in discovery, in fear, in failure. A future, long foreseen, is coming to pass. Another Portia, from the Great Nest by the Western Ocean, but a warrior this time, in the manner of her kind. Her surroundings right now are not Great Nest, but a different metropolis of the spiders. One she thinks of as Seven Trees. Portia is here as an observer, and to lend what aid she might. All around her, the community is a hive of furious activity, as the inhabitants scurry and leap and abseil about their frantic business, and she watches them, her scatter of eyes taking in the chaos on all sides, and compares the sight to a disturbed ant's nest. She is capable of the bitter reflection that circumstances have now dragged her people down to the level of their enemy. She feels fear, a building anxiety that makes her stamp her feet and twitch her palps. Her people are more suited to offence than defence, but they have been unable to retain the initiative in this conflict. She will have to improvise. There is no plan for what comes next. She may die, and her eyes look into that abyss and feed her with a terror of extinction, of unbeing, that is perhaps the legacy of all life. There are signals being flagged by messengers and lookouts posted high in the trees above, as high up as Seven Trees' silk scaffolding extends. They signal regularly. The signal is time counting down. How long this place now has left before the enemy comes. The message wires that are strung between the trunks and their multitude of spun dwellings thrum with speech, as though the community is raging against the inevitability of its destruction. Neither Portia's death nor Seven Trees' destruction is inevitable. The community has its own defenders, for in this time, in this age, every spider conurbation has dedicated fighters who spend their time training for nothing other than to fight. And Portia is here, along with a dozen from Great Nest, in support of their kin. They wear armour of wood and silk, and they have their slingshots. They are the diminutive knights of their world, facing an enemy that outnumbers them by hundreds to one. Portia knows she needs to calm herself, but the agitation within her is too great to be suppressed. She needs some external reassurance. At the high point of the nest's central tree, she finds it. Here is an expansive tent of silk whose walls are woven with complex geometric patterns, the crossing threads drawn out according to an exacting plan. Another handful of her kind are already there, seeking the reassurance of the numinous, the certainty that there is something more to the world than their senses can readily grasp, that there is a greater understanding, that even when all is lost, all need not be lost. Portia crouches down with them and begins to spin, forming knots of thread that make a language out of numbers, a holy text that is written anew whenever one of her people kneels in contemplation, and that is then consumed when they arise. She was born with this understanding, but she has learned it anew as well, coming to temple at an early age, just as she has come here now. The innate, virus-hardwired understanding of these mathematical transformations that she inherited did not inspire her in the same way as being guided through the sequences by her teachers, slowly coming to the revelation that what these apparently arbitrary strings of figures described was something beyond mere invention, was a self-evident and internally consistent universal truth. Of course, in Great Nest, her home, they have a crystal that speaks these truths in its own ineffable way, just as most of the greatest nests have now, that pilgrims from lesser communities often journey great distances to see. She is watched as the votive priestess touches the crystal with her metal probe, feeling the pulsing of the message from the heavens, dancing out that celestial arithmetic for the benefit of the congregation. At such times, Portia knows, the messenger itself would be in the skies overhead, going about her constant journey, whether at night and visible, or hidden by the brightness of the daytime sky. Here in Seven Trees, there is no crystal, but to simply repeat that message, in all its wondrous but internally consistent complexity, to spin and consume and spin again, is a calming ritual that settles Portia's mind, and allows her to face whatever must soon come with equanimity. Her people have solved the mathematical riddles posed by the orbiting satellite, the messenger, as they think of it, learning the proofs first by rote, and then in true comprehension, as a civic and religious duty. The intrusion of this signal has seized the attention of much of the species in a relatively short period of time, because of their inherent curiosity. Here is something demonstrably from beyond, and it fascinates them. It tells them that there is more to the world than they can grasp. It guides their thinking in new ways. The beauty of the maths promises a universe of wonders if they can but stretch out their minds that bit further, a jump they can almost, but not quite, make. Portia spins and unravels and spins, soothing away the trepidation consuming her, replacing it with the undeniable certainty that there is more. Whatever happens this day, even if she should fall beneath the ironclad mandibles of her foes, there is a depth to life beyond the simple dimensions that she can perceive and calculate in. And so, who knows? Then it is time, and she backs out of temple and goes to arm herself. There is considerable variation in the settlements of Portia's people, but to human eyes they would look messy, possibly nightmarish. Seven Trees now encompasses more than the original seven. the thicket of trunks interlinked by hundreds of lines, each part of a plan, each assigned a specific purpose, whether structural, as a thoroughfare, or for communication. The vibratory language of the spiders transmits well down silk threads over some distance, and they have developed nodes of tensioned coils that amplify the signal, so that speech can pass for kilometres between cities in calm weather. The dwelling places of her kin are silk tents pulled taut by support lines into a variety of shapes, suitable to a species that lives its life in three dimensions and can hang from a vertical surface as easily as resting on a horizontal one. Meeting places are broad webs where a speaker's words can be transmitted to a crowd of listeners along the dancing of the strands. In the high centre, shadowing much of the city, is the reservoir, a watertight net spread wide that catches rain and runoff from a grand area around seven trees, the water channeling to it through troughs and pipes from a multitude of smaller rain catchers. Around seven trees, the forest has been cut back by the semi-domesticated local ant.